Okay. Usually before we speak, we sing a song together. It helps us focus on the purpose for us being here and to tune into the spiritual atmosphere that is created when we all sing together, especially when we sing the names of Krishna. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Gopi Janavallabha Girivara Dhari. Gopi Janavallabha Girivara Dhari. Dashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Dashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanacharya. Yamuna Tira Vanachariyam. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihariyam. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunja Vihariyam. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Krishna Krishna Hare Hare. Hare Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Assemble devotees. This little presentation is entitled The Consciousness Explorer. We are the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Consciousness of Krishna, consciousness about Krishna, understanding of Krishna's consciousness is what we're all about. So today we're going to make a little exploration. It's the sort of presentation that I often do at universities and to academics. Analyzing from the first principles of our own intuitions what the reality of consciousness actually is, and particularly addressing the question, is consciousness simply a product of the brain? So now let's see if the tech works. Yes. We're going to start with a question that was actually raised by Jiva Goswami over 100 years before Descartes had the same idea. But in Jiva Goswami, a 16th century philosopher, was writing his compilation of the philosophy of Vaishnavism. And he, his first book is out of six was known as the Tattvasandarbha. In that, he established his epistemology, how we know things and how do we validate things. And I'm going to draw on some of the thoughts that he presented later in the Tattvasandarbha, which also Srila Prabhupada brings into the Bhagavatam. If you want to look it up, it's Canto 2, Chapter 2, Text 35. One of the most amazing purports that Srila Prabhupada has in the Bhagavatam. So, it starts with this point. What can you know for certain? What is that one thing that doesn't have to be proved to you? You don't accept it on the basis of what anyone has told you or even what you've read anywhere. But what you know for certain. And it really boils down to this question here. I have gone too far. How do you know you exist? Right, I exist. Sorry, I've messed that one up, haven't I? It's not a good start. What do we know for certain? Well, we're taking in all sorts of information through our senses, and that can fool us. We think lots of things in our mind, and we know we can think lots of silly, foolish things in our mind. So what is the one thing that I know for certain is that I am the thing that is doing the thinking. I am the thing doing the experiencing. And because of that, I know I exist. Oh, now it's not working. Oh, And I know I exist because I feel, I experience, and I know things. Analyze it for yourself. What is it that convinces you you exist when you wake up in the morning? I'm here. I can see what's going on. I feel things. Yeah, I exist. I am a sentient being. Now, the only thing I can know for certain, this is the difficulty bit, so I'm going to need some help here. The only thing that I can know for certain is that I am a sentient being. I've got no idea about you. So, just to help me, if you also believe that you are a sentient being, that you exist, please put up your hands. That's good, because if you didn't, you wouldn't be getting the feast later. We don't serve it to people who don't exist. So that's confirmed. I'm a sentient thing. So, and this brings us into the issue of consciousness. Now, consciousness is a very big topic in philosophy, and it's involved in neuroscience and in many of the aspects of biology and how science looks at the world. And there's a lot of arguments over this word consciousness, because it's a word that's not fully understood. There are many, many different kind of concepts included within it, and they're mixed up, and people use the words in different ways. So usually when we talk about consciousness with people, we have to say, well, what is your understanding of this word consciousness? What are you talking about when you mention consciousness? And it's amazing the differences that we have. But we have to try and hone in on that. So our work in the BI is to look at this issue from the first principles, I exist. We call that a pre-philosophical axiom, because that's the one thing you can bet your mortgage on. You know? It's that bankable, I exist. So we can build a philosophy from that. It's pre-philosophical. It exists before philosophy. It can't be proved to you by science. It's what you know. This is the starting point. But what Jiva Goswami also did was show that you can then develop this understanding from I am a sentient being. And when we talk about consciousness, this is one example of it. Consciousness. That thing that troubles us, you know, in between naps. It's that terrible thing which kind of forces us to confront reality, to accept, oh, there's things going on around me. Oh, there's things I'm supposed to do. Oh, there's things I'm supposed to think about this. Oh, what a difficult thing this consciousness is. But no. So consciousness gives us this sense of our own existence. It tells us, when we introspect, we understand I have experiences. And my experiences have what are called phenomenal qualities. This is kind of philosopher jargon. Phenomenal qualities. You might be wondering, what is that about? But my experiences have phenomenal qualities. Let me introduce you to this in a very philosophical, academic way. Do you remember, probably back in your school days, you did this thing with the floating finger? Anyone remember that floating finger? No? Well, you're all going to have a go at it now. You take your two fingers like this. You need to hold them about an inch or two, an inch and a half apart. You keep them about this distance from your eyes, you see? And you look through them. You look through and you'll see you've got a floating finger in front of you. If you need to move them a little closer to your eyes or move the fingers a little closer, a little further. Has everyone got their floating finger? Yeah? Yeah? There's a floating finger there, isn't there? This room is full of floating fingers. Do they exist out here? No. But you saw it. You saw something that doesn't exist out here. How is that? Did you ever wonder about something like that? How is it I am experiencing the picture of a finger, but there's no finger in front of my eye? Now, science will say, well, this is stereoscopic vision, you know, because if you close one eye or the other, the finger, the floating finger disappears. Now, that simply explains a very important thing, that this eye is picking up one image of the two fingers, this one is picking up another image of the two fingers. So that means the mixing must be happening somewhere. Where is it happening? Is it happening in the eye? No, it can't be, because each has got different pictures. And they send that, you know, this one goes around here, this, you know, goes to the back of the head. So, does it mix in the brain?
Yes.
But does the brain have a picture in it? You're telling me that if I dissect my brain, I'll find a picture of a finger?
It's on the mind.
It's on the mind. It's post-brain. The mixing the finger isn't out here, it's not in the eyes, it's not in the brain. It's something which you have visualized in your mind. It is post-brain. It is something you experience after the brain has got its information, when something else has taken that data and mixed it together. The mind. This is a power that the brain does not have. These are phenomenal qualities. We're going to talk about those in a little bit of detail now. I'm getting one of these new gizmos, and it's, you know, the trouble is I keep pressing it wrongly. Where are we? Oh, yes. That's where we... No?
Yeah, there,
and then... Jing, please work. Oh, it jumps. So we're going to look at some pre-philosophical insights, because this helps us start our journey on discovering what consciousness is about. We've now discovered that there's things that I can see and experience which cannot be explained by what the physics of the outside world has, what the biology of my eyes have, or what the neurology of my activity in my brain can explain. So now we kind of think about these aspects of consciousness. Please go to the first one. Yes. I am the observer of my body and, what's it say?
Actions,
yes. So, the first thing that Jiva Goswami says is, think about this. There's things outside, you can look to the distance, there's objects, there's a nice roof and, you know, over the hall out there where the devotees are sitting. So that is what I am seeing. I am the seer. I am the seer, I'm here, I am seeing that. I look at you all. You are the seen, I am the seer. You can look at your body, you can look at your hands, and your arms, and your legs. They're what you're seeing, they're the seen, I am the seer. You can even do this as an internal thing. You can think about your tummy and your stomach. What's it feeling? Starting to rumble because you're thinking about the feast? You know? That's the seen, I'm the seer, right? So this tells us that I am experiencing from this position of being the seer. That's the first thing we remember. Then the next one, we go even deeper into our thoughts. Little experiment. I'd like you all just to relax and close your eyes. And now, I'd like you just to let your mind relax and flow. Don't try and force it, don't try and guide it. Just let it flow and just see the way it brings thoughts to your mind. And to seed it, I will say, something nice. Just let it flow. Now, you can keep your eyes closed. You have just allowed a train of thoughts to pass through your mind. Now I want you to think about those thoughts by going back to the first one and trying to trace the steps. Which thought came, and then what did it lead to, then what came next? See if you can recreate the line of thoughts. Not easy. Not if you thought that was easy. Now, please, still, your eyes closed. You can. Now I'd like you to think about yourself as being the entity, the person who is thinking about your thinking, about your thoughts. You were previously just thinking, letting the thoughts flow. Then you thought about your thoughts. Now I want you to think about yourself as the thinker behind of all those thoughts. You are witnessing that. So, now I can come back. So this, we can go into this deeper, but we only have a few minutes here. This helps us to understand that I am simply the witness to my thoughts. I watch them. I experience them as they flow, but I am the witness of them. I am the subject of my experiences. We think about everything that's happening from my perspective, well, from each of our perspective. I see, I think, I am hearing, I feel, I like, I don't like, you know, I want, you know, and so on. It's I, isn't it? I am the subject. Now, no matter how nice we would like to be and how unselfish, we still always will look at the world from this perspective of I, because that is the nature of consciousness. Consciousness is our sense of existence. It's our sense that I am the subject of my experiences. And now we kind of think about this. I am not just the witness of my experiences. I'm not just the observer of life now, but I am the persistent witness of all my thoughts and all my actions throughout my life. That you can do this experiment for yourself. Again, would you like us to close your eyes for a moment with a little reflection? If this is okay for you, please go back to your first day at school. Your first day at school. Try and recall that, or something similar, if it's easier. Just remember where you were, what was going on around you, who else was there, but most importantly, what were you feeling? Were you a little worried? Were you a little thoughtful, you know, nervous about what was going on? Or excited? Happy? Yeah. So you were there then experiencing all those thoughts, all those emotions. And you can come back here. You're here now. The same you. Now, this is controversial for some people because they say, no, I was a different me then. I was a little kid. I had silly thoughts, you know. I was immature. I wasn't developed in my personality at that stage. But listen to how you've just described it. I was, me, my. Right? Yeah, it's the me now, it was the me then. Sure, I was really silly and immature. I've barely got over that. I've hopefully developed a little bit of my personality and matured a bit over these years. But it's still me. I am the persistent witness. Now, that's a big deal, and we're going to come back to that one. All right, what's next? So there's the list for you of our five pre-philosophical insights. And these pre-philosophical insights are certainties for you. And if there's going to be any theory of consciousness given to you, it better satisfy those. So now, here we go. We ask, can all this be explained by what the brain can do? And we're going to look at a thing, phenomenal qualities, and there we have our floating finger, right? Phenomenal qualities. These are, these can be analyzed, and this set of pictures that I'm going to show you is something that was done by a guy called Christoph Koch, who worked with Francis Crick. Francis Crick was the guy who, you know, discovered the structure of DNA along with Watson. And after he dealt with life, he thought, what else will I crack? Oh yes, I'll crack consciousness. So he started working on this early 90s, and Christoph Koch worked with him, and they had their own theory, and they thought they had done cracked that as well. But here's their explanation. So I want you to show that this isn't just me speaking. This is known to the scientific community. Here you go. This is a picture of the outside world, a guy walking his dog in the park. And light bounces off that, goes into the eye. We know how that works. You probably taught that at school. And the light rays hit the cells and the cones and the rods at the back of the retina. They activate photosensitive cells. They turn into electricity, and electricity goes bleep, 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 bleep to the back of the brain. Okay? So now we've got electricity going to the brain. And we can analyze that electricity as various patterns. It contains data. It's electrical patterns containing information and data, no question. It represents the image that came on the retina in electrical form. But it is just electricity. That's all the brain's got, electricity. Ions, positive ions jumping from one neuron to the next. Right? That's all there is. Then there's the sleight of hand. Ding! Where Christoph Koch draws this. That turns into the picture that you experience, the floating finger picture, right? So this is internal. This is what the brain is meant to produce. But the problem is, there is no explanation for that step. Because the picture that you are seeing has its own qualities. They're internal, they're in the mind. They are different to what the brain's got. You can't say, well, of course I see a picture because the world is picturesque. There's lots of things out there with, you know, which are very nice and pretty, and you know, there's colours and everything. Wait a minute. You have no contact with the outside world, really. Because it's my only experience of you is because of the light bouncing off you, which goes into my eyes, and as soon as it goes into my eyes, the light disappears and is turned into electricity. So all I'm getting in my brain is zzzz. But somehow or other that is being translated to me as this beautiful picture of all you lovely people. This is a mystery. Do not underestimate the wonder, the absolute weirdness of this. But we never think about it. We take our visions, we take our what we're seeing and our experiences for granted. We shouldn't. We should analyze them deeply. So we say this is a big question, and it brings up this phenomenon or this concept called qualia. Qualia are the qualities of that inner experience of the floating finger. You know, and of everything that you're experiencing has qualia. So we call the qualities of our inner experience qualia to distinguish them from the properties that we see outside. So when we say qualia, we mean what we experience internally. So if I ever use the word qualia, you're all to say what we experience. Qualia.
What we experience.
Qualia!
What we experience.
Yes, exactly. Now, let me explain more about what qualia are. Okay. Please. Ding. Has this got a battery in it? Is the battery given up, do you think? Oh, there we are. The most commonly described form of qualia is the redness of red. And philosophers like these red balls, you see, because they show redness and roundness. So if you look at it, you're experiencing redness and roundness. Now, there is something that it is like to experience redness. Now, we don't mean the psychological effect that red might feel warm. That's a secondary type of qualia. We mean the raw quality of redness, right? Because it's different to blueness, right? So we have redness, which is different to Blueness, okay? So the most common types of qualia are actually linked to our senses. It's the same, you can do the same analysis for all your sensory activities from a neurological point of view. There's another analysis that's done by the yoga and Sankhya perspective, which is described in the Bhagavatam. But from the neurological point of view, which is what we're trying to look at, all your senses do the same thing. They receive data in different forms. Your ear has pressure waves coming because of vibrations set up. But when that hits the ear, the little eardrum, the tympanic membrane vibrates. Is that sound? Then it sets off movement in these little bones, the ocelles. You know, that's not sound. That puts pressure on the little snail thing called the cochlea. That's just, where's the sound in that? And then it moves little hairs, little cilia, and that sets off electricity. So whatever was happening outside making a big bang, like all the thunder we've had in the last few days, your experience of it, that doesn't touch you. All you've got is a little electricity going into the back of the brain. But boom is what you hear. That's qualia. Touch, taste, things that you taste the pizza. It's just some electricity generated from your tongue. Ooh, that's nice. Smell a rose. Again, just another electricity going to another part. And this time, that smells nice. Or that, you know, and so on. So qualia, qualia are mainly linked to sensory percepts. But, this is really jumping around, I'm afraid. Come on, please. But other types are the feelings that you have internally. If you feel hunger, there is something that it is like to feel hungry, isn't there? Yes, your stomach may be sending messages to the brain, but you experience that as, really need to eat something. Yeah, and that feels hungry, you know? And pain. We think we know all about pain because we've got, you know, we can track the nerve signals. We can look at the brain, see where the C fibers are firing. We can have analgesics. We can knock it out. You think we know everything about pain except why it feels painful. Why should just these neurons firing feel like that? Ow! That is weird. So, even Francis Crick admitted, no one has any explanation for the redness of red, for qualia, the redness of red, the painfulness of pain. We can't explain it. No one's got it. So what all the neuroscientists do is they work on other problems. But they ignore this one, qualia. So let me tell you a bit more about qualia, if I could. All right. Qualia are real, right? In fact, they're the only thing that you experience about the world. Now, transcendental experiences may be something even deeper. But from the external world, all your experiences are qualia related to the things out there. So they're real. The most real thing to you. They're real even when they're illusory. You had a real experience of that illusion. Your mind put it together. And what you experience in the mind is actually your own, is a real experience. Does it relate to the external world? Maybe not. And that you've always got to be careful of. The mind doesn't always tell you exactly what's out there. And we'll see that in a minute. Qualia are private. Only you know what you're experiencing as qualia. I do not know if you see the same colors as I do. We assume we do. We can talk about it. There's a gentleman with a red t-shirt. You know, I'm using red because, thank you. And if I was asked, what does red look like? I would say it looks like that. You would look at that and say, well, that's red. But we don't know if we're actually seeing the same color of redness. We've got no idea. We can still share ideas, but it doesn't mean we actually know. And if you ever tried to explain redness to someone who never sees color, you couldn't do it. So here's an example. You remember this? This dress? All right, we've got to do it. Hands up, everyone who sees white and gold. The dress is colored white and gold. Hands up those who thinks it's blue and black. Argue amongst yourselves later. I've had fights break out in lecture theatres. You see, we're experiencing the same picture. We're experiencing differently. We're seeing different colours. This is qualia. All right? It was black and blue, but that doesn't mean you were right, you black and blue people. It just, you know, because the point is, we experience it differently. Because we think that colour is a property of the outside world. But that's questionable. Sir Isaac Newton was one of the guys who helped us understand the spectrum of visible light. And because of him, we're all taught at school that colour is what? It's related to the wavelength of light, isn't it? And we kind of think that each wavelength is a colour. Nope. That's not right. And Isaac Newton recognised the problem. He looked at the spectrum and said, well, if every wavelength, and you can divide them up quite finely, every wavelength is a colour, then where's magenta in the spectrum? Doesn't exist, does it? But we see the colour magenta, but it's not a wavelength. Why? Because if you have red light and blue light, put them together where they overlap, you'll see magenta. Okay, now we solved it. Right? No. Again, where's the mixing happening? You shine red light, it is of one wavelength, 650 nanometers. Blue light, I think around 400 or 500. They're different wavelengths. But when the eyes get some red and some blue, they're not mixed in the outside world. You don't mix two wavelengths and get a new one. They go into the eyes. They are dealt with by different cones. So there's no mixing in the eyes. Different signals, electrical signals, are going into the brain. So is it the brain mixing them? Well, you could say the brain is trying to put that data together. But if I look in the brain, will I see magenta colours? No. Something is translating that data post-brain and generating the colour of magenta for you. And in fact, all the other mixed colours, they're all coming post-brain. And if you want to prove to yourself that colour isn't a property of light, it's a property of the mind, you can always do this. And I'm only recommending this if there's no sensitivity or problem with your eyes. You can do, again, it's a kiddie thing. You know, you close your eyes like this and you press on the eyeballs just gently and patiently, firmly but not, you know, and you start to see colours, right? Now you're seeing colours without any light involved. QED. All right. We have a little bit of transcendental thing to go here. So that's that. Come on, please. These are the things that you can, these are the various types of illusions that. All right. I'm afraid this is just going in its own time, in its own way. Ultimately, qualia are irreducible, meaning that we have properties of our experience which we cannot reduce to brain activity. Impossible. The brain has certain, we know what the brain does. We know what it's made of biologically. We know how it functions neurologically. And whatever properties we can identify within the brain related to biology and physics do not explain colours, tastes, sounds as sounds, smells as smells that I'm experiencing. There is no explanation for qualia. So that is why it is said that the analysis of perception looking at how light enters the eyes and how it is converted into electricity and where it goes in the brain. That's the easy problems. We can do that amazingly well. However, the hard problem is, where does the picture come from? So if you take anything from this chat today, take this. How is it that the brain only has electricity, but I experience a picture? That is the mystery to ponder. It was nearly 40 years ago that His Grace Sataputta Prabhu introduced me to that. And it turned on a light bulb, which was an internal experience. But the problem isn't over yet for neuroscience, because ultimately you've got to ask, who or what is experiencing this? It's not just that there is qualia that is being experienced. There is someone or something doing the experiencing. So this is why David Chalmers explained that the really hard problem of consciousness is explaining the subjective experience of qualia. And this is Michael Tye, who wrote the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, saying, to many on both sides of the argument, qualia are taken to represent the de facto proof that consciousness, that conscious perception, must be non-neural. And that's what I've just introduced you to, that proof. Now, let's talk about the experiencer. This is a couple of images from some old films. One is The Terminator, one is more recent Iron Man. And one of them has a philosophical error. On the left, you see inside the Terminator's robotic processing. And you can see that it has there's all the information about what he's seeing is being presented on a screen with words and data. That is an error. Computers, robots do not need a screen for themselves. They don't turn their data into qualia. They don't need to. They can deal with it all as digital information. They can respond as necessary. They can set up whatever they need to do digitally. Anyone who's involved in computers knows that, right? Whereas on the right, you've got this gentleman and he's got this big exoskeleton robotic body. And what's going on in that body and what it is picking up from the environment is being presented to him on a screen. Is that philosophically correct? Yes. Why? Because the body is trying to present, tell him what's going on. It can't just say, well, I've got all this digital data, you should know. No, it's saying, let me present this digital data to you in a way that you can appreciate. So that is really the way we experience the world. There is a flow of data through our senses into our brain, but it has to be translated by the mind and then presented to us in the form of qualia, in the form of thoughts, which are not neural themselves. They are obviously related. All our experience is obviously related to what our senses in the brain are picking up. No question, there's a correlation to a degree. It's not 100%, but it's a correlation. But it ultimately is a re-representation of the world in our mind to us. So that sets up what we call the three-function model. And this seems to be the only way to really account and to create a framework for understanding how we experience the world, how we sense our own existence, how we understand ourselves as the subject of our experience, the witness, and the persistent witness. We have to recognize that there are three absolutely distinct sets of properties and functions. And in science, and in the only way that you can categorize anything in this world is according to what it is like and what it does, its properties and its functions. Science never tells you what anything is or is made of. It never tells you that. It can only say, This seems to be composed of things which have this property and this function, like atoms. We define them that they are like this and do that. And what are they made of? Well, quarks and gluons, you know, make up the protons and neutrons. What are they? Things that look like this and do that. And what are they made of? Well, quantum fields. What are they like? Well, they are like this and do this. Isn't it? We only define things in science according to what their properties are and their functions. So we're doing the same. And when we do that, we find that there are three distinct baskets of properties and functions. And they should be treated individually. They're related, of course, no question, but they need to be understood independently. The first one is the physical and biological and neurological properties and functions. And that makes up our body, brain, and the whole world. We can explain a lot through those things, no question. Science has become brilliant at investigating those properties. But it doesn't explain everything. It doesn't explain qualia. It doesn't explain the person who's having that. So we need other baskets to put the properties in. And qualia don't fit in that first basket. We need a separate basket for them. And that's cognitive properties and functions. Okay? That's that basket. That's where qualia, that's where all your thoughts reside. That's where actually all your memories reside. We call that the mind in simple terms. The Sankhya obviously analyzes it even more deeply, but generally we can say mind. But that isn't enough. That basket can't even hold consciousness. Because consciousness is the experience of the experiencer. And the mind is not the experiencer. It's what we experience, not who is doing the experiencing. So we have to have another basket. Consciousness, functions, and properties. That's the three function model. And actually, this is something that you can get across, and it's very usable. We tend to use this in all our daily lives. You know, how are you feeling about your body? You know, basically, how are you, the experiencer, consciousness, feeling qualia about your external thing, your body? Right? We automatically use this system, but we use it kind of without thinking. Now, let's talk a little bit about the brain. These are things that okay. Whatever we've moved on to, we'll take. Take small mercies, whichever slide comes up. I've been very heavy on this idea that the brain is not capable of producing qualia or consciousness. So I got to be fair here. I have scoured all the literature on this. I've talked to so many people in academia and in the universities. And I've asked them, please tell me, you know, let's gather all the direct evidence that says that consciousness comes from the brain. Let's get it all together. So I now want to present it to you. Yep, that's it. I presented this at dozens of universities in the last 10 years. No one has ever questioned that. There is no direct evidence. There's some justification, you know, some people have ideas that try to justify it, but actually those ideas usually are better explained by our three-function model. So, what the brain can't do, it can't do qualia, it can't do subjective experience, it can't even explain the richness of our experience, that's a whole other subject. It can't even tell you that you're experiencing in real time, because there is a time gap between what your brain can process of sound and coming in the ear and what it processes about visual stimulus. Do you know the difference between the two in the brain? Half a second. There's a half second difference in what the brain can do between visual and audio processing. So it can't even give you a real-time experience. It needs help. It needs image enhancing. Those are the activities of the mind. The mind acts as this interface between our brain and ourselves. It is like that screen of the computer. It's showing us in a different way what the computer is doing inside. It's taking that digital data and making it available to us. So why do we have this screen of awareness? Because the body needs to talk to someone. It's not itself. Us, the consciousness bit. So now we look at kind of consciousness. So when we talk about consciousness, we are defining it precisely. We don't use, you know, we often talk about the soul. But, you know, in academic terms, the soul is understood in very broad ways, and everyone's got a different take on it. And sometimes they think, oh, you're trying to bring religion in. No, we haven't talked religion yet. We're just talking science and philosophy so far. So we define consciousness in terms of the Atma. And the Atma, what have we said there, is the... Could you read it out to me? Because I can't see, and I'll get it wrong. Very good. So, it's an individual entity of consciousness. It's what we talked about. It is me, the seer, the witness, the observer, the knower. It's me, the original self of me. We have many additional layers of selfhood that we add on to ourselves. But when we talk about the self, we mean the core self, the conscious self. That one who's doing the experiencing of all the other types of selfhood. So, let's look at the mind. Here is, on one side, the brain, and it's feeding things into the mind through sensory activity. And on the other side, we have consciousness shining its light. Probably the best way to think of the relationship between the Atma and the mind is that it shines chitta. It shines the light of its awareness on the mind. And that's how what we're experiencing is whatever we're shining our light on. And in our conditioned state, embodied state in this world, what consciousness, the Atma, is shining its light on is our mind. And that is represented, and I really hope that this goes in order, because yeah. And what the mind, I hope that shows it nicely, but this kind of shows the drama around. This is meant to be a picture of a whole dramatic scene on stage. That's the mind. It's presenting the world to you as if it's a whole drama unfolding all around you. And you are the watcher of it, and you're identifying deeply with what's going on. You are the observer of all that. But that isn't good enough for us. We don't just want to be the observer, the audience of the drama. We want to be in it. Oh, there we have. There we have. We've appeared in it, right? That is our persona self. That is our the projection of our sense of self within the picture of the mind. It's like you might do if you are playing a virtual reality game. You project yourself into the game by taking on an avatar. That avatar isn't you, but it feels like you. You experience it like you. You invest your hopes, your ambitions, your aspiration, everything in that avatar. You hope it will succeed in its quest, whatever it's doing. And if it gets trouble or gets killed, it's painful. So in the same way, the Atma invests itself in this persona self. And more, it invests itself. And each time it invests itself, you can see the consciousness of its own awareness of its own selfhood is waning. And the strength of the mind is increasing. Until there's a point, I don't know if we got there yet. Till there's a point where the Atman no longer thinks of itself as being the conscious self. We only think of ourselves as that actor on that stage, in the drama that's unfolding in our mind, and just at the mercy of what the external world is feeding us through our senses. We try to respond to it with our own willfulness. We have volition, we have free will. We try to respond, but we're only responding as this character according to what the mind generates as our desires and our actions. And that's what we mean by being totally under the control of that situation. But it needn't be. This is where we need awakening. If you're lost in this virtual reality of this world and it's troublesome to you, we need someone who can come and tap us on the shoulder and say, look, there's more to life than being wrapped up in that drama, in that game. You know, as parents, you know, their kids are absorbed. Please step out of the game, you know, go outside and play or something, do something else. There's more to it. So we need someone to tap us on the shoulder. And in spiritual life, that person who taps us on the shoulder is the devotee of Krishna. But maybe our spiritual master. And here we are on Father's Day. It's nice to also give credit. It was wonderful to hear giving credit to all the fathers and in all their responsibilities and all the love that they shower on their children. But we also remember our spiritual father, Srila Prabhupada, who showed a lot of love in tapping us on the shoulder and saying, you can do better than this. Really, you can do better. You can reawaken your sense of being that spiritual being, the Atma. You can be free. You can direct your chitta not into the material world. Why not shine your chitta, your consciousness, your awareness at Krishna, the source of all existence? So beautiful, so attractive, so loving, so playful, so kind. Why wouldn't you want to shine your consciousness on Krishna? That's what we mean by Krishna consciousness. A change of focus may not change everything else, but if we change our focus of our sense of who we are, understanding my existence, understanding that I am this eternal being. I am non-temporal. That's the other thing. Remember, I am the persistent witness. I am non-temporal. I watch things change. I watch the world change from this situation to that situation in the next moment and the next moment, and those just flow past, and new situations flow up from the from the future to my vision, and they pass in the next one. But I am the person who is viewing the changes of the world. And we're also viewing the changes in our mind. So time affects the world, it affects our mind, but it doesn't affect the Atma. The Atma is outside of time. We say eternal, but people don't always understand what eternal means. They think it just means a long, 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 long time. No, eternal means outside of time. Never touched by it. Never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor any of us. Nor will any, in the future, will any of us cease to be. That's non-temporal. So wouldn't it be nice to be told, instead of just being absorbed in this temporary kind of conditioned world, there is a non-temporal state that we could all be invited to. That's what's on offer within Krishna consciousness, as many of you well know and are well dedicated to. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Do we take questions? Okay. Is there a microphone to be passed around?
Sometimes in the Vedic scriptures, they introduce the terminology of the mind and the heart. What can you say about that?
Yeah, the terminology is often linked. You know, this word chitta, which basically means our conscious awareness, that's how Prabhupada uses it. And chaitya, the heart. These are all connected. Because the mind, where does it reside? It actually resides in the area of the heart. So that's actually where we are. We all think we're up here, because I'm looking out. Whenever, wherever I put my head seems to be where I can know what's going on. But actually the knowing is going on here in the heart. So many people look at this word chitta and regard it as something that means the consciousness of me, of the Atma, within the heart.
And knowledge, where does that fit in?
What do you mean by knowledge?
So there's a material knowledge, which has to do with the mind, and then there's the spiritual knowledge, which has to do with the Atma?
That's right. The material knowledge is what we have fed into the mind through lives, not just this life, but maybe many lives, where we filled the mind. And everything we experience always gets put into the mind. It's stored there. Everything. And according to our intelligence, which is guided by Paramatma, we are allowed to draw on that storehouse of experiences. And that becomes our material knowledge. But sometimes Krishna is very clever. And he draws on things which help to inspire you to gather spiritual knowledge, which actually is an enriching of the Atma. It's a reawakening of the Atma back to its original knowledge. We are originally full of knowledge. But as we saw with that little kind of image of the circle with the dot as consciousness, and it starts to disappear as it identifies with the mind, you're losing that knowledge. Whereas when we reawaken, the Atma comes back and starts to appreciate the knowledge that is already present and been reawakened within it. We're cleansing the mirror of our consciousness, chitta, you know, chaito darpanam, cleansing that. And therefore revealing knowledge, real knowledge to ourselves.
I think just building off of that question, it was very similar to what I wanted to ask, which was where does the intelligence come into the picture? Because there's the mind and then there's the self, and intelligence isn't necessarily a spiritual thing, right? Because there can be material knowledge. It seems like the gathering of knowledge, but somebody could be really distracted by material knowledge and material intelligence and not actually use it to gain understanding of the self. So it seems maybe there's spiritual intelligence or material, like where does that come in that image of the mind and then the self? It seems that it comes in between, right? Like the intelligence comes in between, or what role
this
does that
play? This is a very important thing, that the three kind of subcategories that are identified for the cognitive functions. One is that persona, self, we call the ahankar. And then we talk about mind as mana, which is the storehouse of all these thoughts and is generating. The thinking, willing, and feeling processing happens there. The mind isn't conscious. It's not conscious thinking. It's not conscious willing. It's not conscious feeling. It's processing, much like the brain does, but it's done in a subtler form. And then there's intelligence. And intelligence is that factor which is guiding where the mind is going to draw from and what ultimately gets presented on the screen of consciousness. So that may mean that if it senses that the persona is dedicated to material pursuits and has an image of itself being successful in this world, according to their desires and also according to their karma, the intelligence will guide them in certain ways to make decisions, to action certain things, to learn certain things, and it will help organize the mind so that they can progress in that. But in one sense, that's forgetfulness of their real thing. And what Krishna says about the intelligence is Matak Smritir Gyanam Apovanam. I am the source of remembrance, forgetfulness, and knowledge. So you can have both. If you want forgetfulness knowledge, you can get that. Intelligence will do that for you. And intelligence will also give you remembrance knowledge. It's not two different types of intelligence, actually. It's still the one intelligent factor. And as Prabhupada explains in that purport, intelligence is the form direction of the supersoul. It is directly related to the supersoul, the Lord in the heart. It's Krishna there. You should recognize in buddhi, intelligence, not as something you're meant to control as the yogis do, but as Krishna. So we pray to Krishna to help give us guidance, give us that, awaken us to understanding that helps us in our spiritual practice rather than entraps us more. Have we got another one? Yeah. Shout it out, thank you. And I'll repeat for those on Zoom. You come to a lecture, you get very deep questions, you know, from all of you, you know, it's amazing. Yes, the actual process of Krishna consciousness is very interesting. Yes, we want you to understand the distinction between your mind and yourself. We want to understand, even within the mind, understand mana, buddhi, and ahankara. So those are important to know. The different processes mentioned in the Vedas. Some try to control body, you know, through austerities. Some try to control the senses, tapasya. Some try to control the mind through jnana. Some try to control buddhi through yoga. Our process is actually the ahankar. Our process is to change who we think we are in this world. And what is, because Prabhupada always said, you're not that body, you are the eternal servant of Krishna. That's directly trying to relate to your ahankar. Instead of seeing myself as this persona, self who's, you know, defined by our body, by our family, by our society, by everything we do and all our thoughts, we're now trying to see ourselves, our identity, our real identity, as the eternal servant of Krishna. And the amazing thing about that is that sense of a persona resonates with our actual self. For the first time in God knows how many lives, we have got a concept of ourselves that resonates with our real self. That's amazing. So that's what we do. We are working on the ahankara. We are the eternal servant of Krishna. But it's difficult just to kind of think, I am the eternal servant of Krishna. So we, in our early sadhana stage of our practice of Krishna consciousness, we tend to have to create a sense of ourselves as a devotee of Krishna. And we do that by understanding, I am a devotee. I associate with other devotees. I am a member of an association of ISKCON. I have my spiritual master who I have related with in this lifetime. So all that's very real. It's not just airy fairy, yes. You know, like many people do, it's all one. I am Brahman, I am God, you know. It's not airy fairy like that. This is practical. You know, we can live the life of a devotee. We can practice life as a devotee. From the morning we wake to when we fall asleep, we are living true to that. Now, it could be an illusion, but the real experience is what is happening in our hearts. Is our heart becoming awakened to its real self through that? And if that's happening, then you're doing it right. If that's not happening, then your image of yourself as a devotee, there's something that... But really, the process is so good that it does awaken. So have no fear.
Hare Krishna. So I was curious, if we have atmas as individual units of consciousness, it's almost like they all have subjective reality. But I was just curious, from preaching perspective, in the scientific language, how do you explain that there is an objective reality and those connect? And actually, you know, from subjective reality, one might think that I will do what I want and I'll get what I want. But actually, you know, we do what we want, but we get what we get. But I'm just curious, how do you explain that point?
Yeah, another very important point about how we relate to objective reality. Well, you got to know that physics no longer believes in objective reality. They call that rather naive. Physics now believes that there is some link between consciousness, whatever that is in their heads, and how reality manifests. There is some kind of interaction happening, and that's all because of the kind of the quantum analysis that they've done. It's not because of quantum theory. It's because of quantum actuality. It's because of the experiments. You know, people think, well, quantum theory is weird. You know, why should we believe in it? The only reason that it's not that quantum theory is weird, quantum actuality is weird. What we've seen in the experiments, what we've seen, the observations we see, it's weird. You know? Theories haven't really caught up with it. We haven't quite got to explain it. But we now know that you cannot just assume that the world is divorced from consciousness, from intention. And there's huge amount of work going on in that. And we do analysis of that. And if you want to look into that more, I'm going to do a little advert. You should check out the Atma Paradigm lectures online. If they're on YouTube as the Atma Paradigm. That's the long version. There's a shortened version, which we recorded yesterday, which is now up, which is on the BIHS website. It should be, there'll be a link from that. And we get into that link between how consciousness actually relates and interacts with the world. It's a two-way process. This world is participative. There's a real world out there, you know? And no one's saying it's not real. But mind is also as real. It's not made of the same stuff, but it's just as real. And consciousness is definitely just as real. So it's all real and they all interact. So nothing is 100% objective. Nothing is 100% subjective. I think that's about all I can say in this.
I guess I'll need to look it up.
Yeah, but we'll be here for... That's the sort of thing you chat over a gulab jamun. Was there any other things? Krishna Bhajan.
Hare Krishna. First, when you were talking about the qualia and our experience of like the color red or tastes, how is it that there are, for example, when it comes to food, large numbers of people will agree that, you know, certain foods are nice, and there are certain things that we would never even consider eating. Whereas Prabhupada often talks about pigs being happy when they get to eat some stool, right? So the pig has the pig's got a different kind of perception of what's nice and what's not nice. So where are we getting that kind of species-specific qualitative kind of...
Excellent, very good. The Bhagavad Gita describes that each body can be defined in this way. A set of 10 senses gathered around the mind. 5 knowledge-acquiring senses, you know, the ones that we perceive with and receive information, and 5 working senses, the things that we do stuff with, hands, legs, and so on. So the perceptions, every species has a different set of senses linked to a different mentality. And according to what those senses derive from the world in terms, and we're getting technical now, the mind goes out through the sense, gathers the tanmatras which are inherent within the different objects, and brings the tanmatras back from that according to what that sense is able to do, and brings that into the mind and qualia form. The atma inside that pig goes, that was really good stuff. You know? Because that's what its senses are good at getting, and that's what its mind is geared to exploring. And every creature is enjoying its senses one way or other, whatever it's getting.
The other question was about amnesia and actually brain damage. About 40 years ago, a devotee was in a serious accident and her brain was split. And I had the service of visiting her in hospital in London because there wasn't any devotees there who knew her. So I would go every day, and I discovered that, first of all, she didn't seem to be able to remember anything when she recovered consciousness. But then I would show her pictures of different devotees that she knew, and ask her who they were. And if I prompted, like by saying the first syllable, say of somebody's name, then she would remember it. And I could do that with Bhagavad Gita verses. I would give the first couple of words of a Bhagavad Gita verse, then boom, she'd give me the verse. But without the prompting, if I asked her, okay, what's, you know, Bhagavad Gita, the verse this or that, she couldn't do it. So what on earth is going on there?
Very interesting.
And why do people get amnesia?
Well, what you described, when you say the brain was split, that means the corpus callosum was cut?
The corpus callosum... It was here, in the frontal lobe.
Ah, that's a different one.
Because the car flipped over and crashed against tree trunk. And so her brain was kind of somewhat split there.
In simple terms, think of it like this. If you have your computer, your phone, whatever you use as a processor, if the processor gets damaged, will you expect to see the same thing come up on the screen? You know? There's something, the processing... We're not saying the processing of the brain isn't helpful. It's important. Now, amazingly, the mind can ultimately overcome even the worst problems of the brain, you know, and it can help to rebuild the brain. Mm. But so that's why your prompts were setting up action within the mind in order to access data that normally it would have may have linked it with some kind of neural pathway or something. But if that's not available to it, it has to dig deeper. It has to go into the repository of its subconscious mind. But all memory is there. It just, we may not be able to access it as easily.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now we're hearing the quality of the conch. But this is transcendental. Hare Krishna.